Yeah, Senate Education and General Government Committee to order. Colleagues, first thing, some housekeeping. You all have the OHSU response letter that was distributed to you. If you haven't seen it, this is a hard copy. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 901. Did you want to do a very quick summary?
Sure, Dana? Senator. The SB 901 allows a school district that has not offered benefit plans through OEB, that's the Oregon Educators Benefits Board, to provide or contract for benefit plans other than those provided by the board if the premiums for the district's benefit plans are equal to or less than the premiums for the comparable benefit plans provided by the board. It also requires an independent actuary to make a determination of comparability.
And Senator Bonamici is spearheading this bill, and Senator, would you like to expand on that and let us ask you some questions?
I would be happy to. Would you like me to go down into the hot seat? Would it give me more credibility down there?
Your preference.
I'll go down there.
That was a hell of a straight line, but I let it go.
Okay, colleagues, you should also know that you've received a letter from Legislative Council on this. You also have a copy of the statute.
Thank you, Senator Haas, committee members. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in the northeast corner of Washington County and northwest corner of Multnomah County. And I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 901. I wanted to explain how this bill came about. It started back in 2007 when I was serving in the House, and Senate Bill 426, which created the Oregon Educator Benefit Board, was being discussed. And some of us who were serving in the House and perhaps in the Senate, although I found that we don't communicate as much as we should about certain issues, some of us who were serving in the House were hearing from our school districts that they were concerned about the cost to the district of going into the benefit board because they believe that they could provide insurance plans, comparable insurance plans, at a lower cost. And so throughout those discussions, it was explained that there would be a provision in the bill that would provide that if a district could provide comparable benefits at a comparable cost, they would not need to go into OEB. And so that provision was in Section 17 of Senate Bill 426. And it reads that the board shall offer a range of benefit plan designs sufficient to ensure that when benefit plans are first provided by the board to a district, the district and district employees can choose benefit plans that are comparable in design to and are not more expensive than the comparable cost of the benefit plans the district provided immediately before the purchase of the benefit plans provided by the board. That's a very long sentence, but that was the comparable plan provision that was in Senate Bill 426. So when Senate Bill 426 passed and began being implemented, some of us were still hearing from school districts that they believed that they could provide comparable plans without, or at a better cost, without going into OEB. And some districts are not in OEB because of the timing of their collective bargaining agreements. Many districts, if not most districts in the state, are already participating in OEB. Some are not, either because they had another exemption for being self-insured or having a trust, or because they are not at the end of their collective bargaining agreements. Additionally, at least two districts have been granted waivers by OEB because they have shown that they can provide comparable plans at a lower cost. So when this session started and we were continuing to discuss these issues among my colleagues and with the district, I went to look at the ORS to find the comparable language that I just read to you from Section 17 of Senate Bill 426. And lo and behold, I found it, but I found it in a footnote. And that footnote is I brought my book with me. It's in Volume 6, and it's on page 490, and that section is down in a footnote. And so I called Legislative Council, and I said, Legislative Council, why is the comparability language from OEB in a footnote? And they said that's because where it was put in the statute, it expired. It expired on October 1st of 2008, because the sentence that I read you about comparability was underneath another section that expired on October 1st of 2008. And that concerned me because the conversations that I've had with OEB, they've been very cooperative, and in fact they came here when we had our first hearing about OEB and talked about how they are, it is their intention to grant a waiver to districts who can provide comparable benefits at a lower cost. But my concern was that that language is not in effective language in the Oregon Revised Statutes. And so even though I understand there's a rule that OEB has passed to deal with comparability, I'm concerned on behalf of the districts who are not yet in OEB that that language is not in, does not have the force of law because it is in a part of the statute that has expired. And it's my understanding, I know the Legislative Council couldn't be here today, but it's my understanding that when the statute is, the volume is reprinted, it won't even be there. It'll go away because it's expired language. So that led to the drafting of Senate Bill 901 to make sure that for the districts who are not currently in OEB, meaning the districts who are not at the time in their collective bargaining agreement that triggers their going into OEB, and for the districts who have been given a waiver, which I understand is temporary, that there will still be comparability language in the statute pursuant to Senate Bill 901. There are other provisions in the bill that deal with having an independent actuary make the determination of comparability and making a comparability determination over a period of time longer than a year, and I'm going to let others who are here today discuss the merits of those particular provisions, but I wanted to explain the comparability part, and I hope it wasn't too confusing, but I'm happy to answer questions. Or try to answer.
Senator, just to summarize then, it's your opinion then in that date in Section 17 of the law, because it expires, then so too does the section below that also expire.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was told by Legislative Council, because they were all in the same section, Section 17, and the first part of Section 17 says before October 1st, 2008, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board shall enter into contracts for health benefit plan and dental benefit plan coverage of eligible employees in accordance with Section 3 of the Act.
All right.
So that was something that had to be done, that OEB had to enter into plans before October 1st of 2008, and the second section is in that section. So according to Legislative Council, the whole thing is expired as of October 1st, 2008. And I want to clarify, Mr. Chair and committee, that even though I have a law degree, it's pretty dusty, and I haven't practiced law for a while, and this is not legal advice. It's based on what I was told by Legislative Council and sort of common sense reading of the statute, Mr.
Chair. We understand. But that's what this bill covers, is
correct.
In fact revalidating, if you will, or validating that section without
correct.
A date.
Which, Mr. Chair, is consistent with what we were told in committee and what I've been told by OEB, that they intend to honor that comparability language, but it's not in the statute, according to Legislative Council.
Senator Bonamici, you know, because we've gone over this, one of the problems that we're trying, all of us are trying to avoid, is the situation where districts can go in and out trying to get the best health care, and we know we want to avoid that in any kind of a pool situation. What language do you have in 901 do you think prevents that?
Well, I explained that to Legislative Council, and I did have a couple of meetings with Legislative Council during the drafting of this, and that is Section 2 on page 2, lines 9 through 11, is intended to apply to districts that have not offered before the effective date of this 2009 Act benefit plans provided and administered by the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. And that is the way Legislative Council chose to draft the provision to make it clear that this is for districts who are not currently in OEB. It is not for districts who are in OEB. This is not intended to allow districts to move in and out of the pool, only to apply to the comparability determination that needs to be made when they are faced with entering OEB because of the timing of their collective bargaining agreement or because their waivers have expired.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Bonamici? Senator Cruz?
Yeah. So, several questions, Mr. Chair. So, for a district that's already in OEB, they're stuck. There's nothing they can do about it, correct?
In this bill, there's nothing that they can do about it.
So this bill is actually just addressing a very few school districts.
Addressing the school districts who are not currently in OEB.
A very few.
I'm sorry. Oh, excuse me. Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I'm sorry, I don't know the number of districts who are not currently in OIB.
But less than half, certainly.
That would probably be correct.
Mr. Chair, I still think this still leaves it. I think this still leaves some. I mean, the due diligence that has to be presented to continue to not necessarily opt out, because I'm not sure that it is truly an opt out, or if it's a waiver at this point in time. I still think at this point, based on the actuarial analysis, would OEB have to waive them out, or could they opt out?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, the term opt out sort of refers to, it sounds like somebody who's already in and wants to get out.
No,
so a waiver would be somebody who is not going into OEB because they can provide comparable benefits at a lower cost.
Okay, clarification. For a district that's not currently in, is it their choice to stay out, or would it require OEB to waive them out?
It requires a comparability analysis.
Okay, but still.
Mr. Chair,
whose decision is it ultimately?
Well, under this bill calls for an actuarial analysis to be done based on an independent actuary. Does that answer your question, Senator Cruz?
Well, I'm not sure this bill really answers my question, but I still think that, I mean, because currently there have been two districts that have been waived, and but that's still, the decision is made by OEB, not the district. The district may want out, but OEB is the one that makes the ultimate decision, and I guess my real problem with this is we are still, for all those districts that are in, and I heard from all of my districts last session that this was going to cost them more money, and they have no option at this point. They're in, and there's nothing they can do about it. They can't do an actuarial study to prove that they should be out, and I think that's a problem.
No, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, based on the testimony that was provided when we had the informational hearing about OEB, all of the districts who are in are saving somewhere between 1% to 18%, according to the testimony that was provided in our other hearing.
It was selected testimony.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator, welcome you back up here. And we'll call Debbie Johnson and Sue Robertson of Beaverton up.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Debbie Johnson, RN. I'm the Health Resource Coordinator for Beaverton School District. And with me, I'm pleased to introduce you to Sue Robertson.
I'm the Chief Human Resource Officer for the Beaverton School District.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for allowing us to testify in favor of Senate Bill 901. I have four words for all of you. Thank you very much. We are very pleased to see 901. It addresses the issues we brought before you in January. We told you that this would be something that is fiscally prudent for the district. We appreciate the clarification that you as a committee have put together with Senator Bonamici, and we appreciate and welcome the clarification that has been placed in the bill. What we asked for, in addition to what Senator Cruz said, for opt-out, we also asked for clarification of someone independent. You heard OEB testimony in January, and it wasn't strongly defended as to why it could not be an independent. In addition, we also spoke about a three-year analysis, not an annual analysis. As you know, the Beaverton School District has had their own plans for over 25 years, and we're a mature group. So OEB has been in place since October 1 of 2008. We're right in the middle of a comparability analysis right now. So you're comparing a mature group to a group of immature claims for the last 6 months. That's what I wanted to bring across to you. And Sue also has a message to you from our district.
And I, too, would like to thank you for this bill. We have been asking for this for quite some time, and we do feel like this is the fiscally prudent way to go with our taxpayers. As Debbie said, we have a long-standing history of providing benefit plans at a very fiscally responsible manner. And by our calculations, it would have cost us about $8-plus million to go in this next year. And given our current economic climate, you couldn't be more timely in this for us. It's very, very much appreciated. We know the work with the ARs that OEB has done is very good. However, the confusion with the law, this wording, this language really helps us with that, to make that clear to our constituents. We also believe the objectivity of an independent actuary is another piece that we had requested. The independent actuary, right now we have some difference in opinion as far as what the cost to the Beaverton School District would be if we did go into OEB this coming year. And the numbers they're not the same. Either way, it's quite a bit more that we would be paying if we did go in. But we believe the independent actuary addresses that concern. And then finally, I would also say that three-year provision is very helpful. It's very difficult for us to plan every year as we're developing our budget to wait until May to be able to determine whether or not we go into OEB. This three-year comparability piece would also help us with making sure that we don't just get a 1 year that's an anomaly. Either way, whether we would have an especially difficult year or OEB would have an especially good year, this gives us good data so that when we go in, we know it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
This bill also respects the districts that have been cost efficient for many years, and also is respectful to your constituents and your taxpayers. So we are very appreciative of this.
Okay, and even though there may be an additional cost for that independent actuary, that's not an issue.
We believe that's a fair thing to
fair.
Do, splitting the cost.
It's fair.
Questions? Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read the bill, there are no provisions for timelines for once you initiate to completion. Is that a concern at all to you?
The timelines for when we
for
are
the
asked.
Actuarial and to reach a timely conclusion.
The only timeline I saw in the bill, Senator Morse, was when, if this bill goes through and becomes law, it becomes in effect immediately. Upon, and right now, I'm sure that would be a question for us and for OEB as to when this would begin, because right now there's more than one district besides us who are going through the comparability analysis right now. We have submitted to OEB our plan designs, and they have told us we are comparable in plan design, and now it is our time to give them our rates here in the next few weeks. So we were under the understanding we would still proceed with that, and then a decision would be made by OEB at that time. I don't know the timeliness of this bill becoming law and how it would impact that for now.
Mr. Chair, my question was not so much now,
okay,
as in the future when you're looking at renewals and making decisions. There's no reference to timelines in the bill, and I just raise that question. Is it of concern?
I don't think there would be a concern, because if we're not in OEB, and then if there's 3 years that go by, then I would imagine OEB would be asking us to come forward again at some point in the future. So I guess I hear what you're saying, that it would be helpful to have a timeline based that would tell us exactly when the 3 years would start.
And I think I understand, too, that our renewal date is different than what OEB's is, so we do understand there will be some lag time there. Ideally, you know, we'd have it earlier in the spring, but having to do it once every 3 years versus annually is helpful.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Denise Hall from OEBB.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'd like to also introduce Steve Marlowe. He's our Assistant Attorney General that supports the board, and I have him here today. For the record, my name is Denise Hall. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. And I'd like to say that, like, Senate Bill 901 will require the Oregon Educators Benefit Board to allow school districts to opt out of benefits if they aren't able to offer comparable plans at a comparable cost. Currently, by rule, OEB does allow districts to opt out if we can't meet the cost comparability standards, and that has been a practice for the entire year since the program's inception, where we allowed the districts to opt out. There are three districts that have opted out because we weren't able to meet that cost comparability. Prior to the board filing this comparability rule, we basically looked at the intent under Section 17.2, Chapter 7 of Oregon laws, and put that in place. And according to Senate Bill 901, the school districts that are not currently participating, and there are, I believe, six districts in a whole that are not participating in the OEB program at this time. And it would...
Excuse me, Ms. Hall, could you tell us what those three districts, which, did you identify those three districts?
The three districts are Fern Ridge, Three Rivers, and Bethel. Was allowed to opt out. There was one group from Bethel that decided to come into OEB, but the district was given that provision. Okay, it's OEB's current practice, based on the intent, that the board analyze those plans on an annual basis, based on the language in Senate Bill 426-2007. And the comparability analysis is completed by Watson Wyatt. It is the actuarial firm that OEB actually went through a procurement and contracting process and selected them in 2007. And they've been providing consulting services for the design, implementation, and then the administration of the board programs. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 901 today. And again, I'm available for questions, and Stephen Marlowe, our Attorney General, was here too.
Okay. Well, thank you both. We'll keep you on standby here for a second. We have others.
I think that's it, Senator.
Is that it?
And
anyone
those are
else?
Others that didn't sign up.
Who didn't sign up, who want to testify on Senate Bill 901, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hall. I wanted to ask you, just so I'm clear on terminology, when you use the term opt out, you mean not enter, as opposed to going out of something that a district is already in. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, yes. That's opting out is not coming into the program rather than leaving it once they're there.
Okay. And follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank
sir.
You. And I think this question is probably best for Mr. Marlowe. There's reference in the testimony to the comparability opt-out rule, and if there isn't any comparability language in the ORS, is there still authority for a rule on comparability?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I was unaware of Legislative Council's opinion up until you told me. I respectfully offer a differing opinion as to the Section 17, which is, and I understand that, you know, I don't have it in writing, but the opinion that is, but I have the code, and so the Section 17 does say before October 1st of 2008 that OEBB is to enter into contracts. Okay, so then, and then there's a period, and then there's another section, subsection 2, which does not start with before October 1 of 2008. So there's a new sentence and a new subsection, which then says that the board shall offer a range of benefit plans, and so which are not more expensive, and as you said. And so now, consistent then with the rest of the statute, which was that districts would not all enter on October 1, 2008. They would enter, you know, on a rolling period. There were supposed to be 3 years of this, where districts would not finally enter until 2010. So we interpreted the statute as not, as Section 17, subsection 2, not expiring. For the two reasons that, one, the sentence in subsection 2 doesn't say that, and two, it would negate for the rest of the districts, these districts that were supposed to come in on the second and third year of this period, you know, that what the bill's old, you know, structure originally was not for everyone to come in on 2008. So it was to come in later, and so it seemed inconsistent to interpret it. I had not read that or heard of that opinion before. So our position before was based on that subsection 2 of section 17 of the Oregon laws was effective today. And would continue, on this period of saying that before the district's first purchase, which wasn't supposed to happen for districts until 2010. So our authority was based on the law, this session law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment that's precisely why I have Senate Bill 901 to add it back in. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you both. Appreciate you coming here. Anyone else want to testify on Senate Bill 901? Going once. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 901. And I'm opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 374. Ms. Richardson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 374 declares the first Friday in December as Oregon Civics Day for teachers. It urges school districts to encourage teachers to participate in professional development opportunities. Focus on civics on that day. It does declare an emergency. And you do have fiscal and revenue statements available on this before you as well.
Senator Bonamici is our go-to senator today. And did you want to make some comments on...
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I'll stay up here for this since I really don't need to be... questioned, I hope, on this one.
You missed some senators. So
I missed some senators. I'm sorry about that, Senator Cruz. Mr. Chair and Committee, Senate Bill 374 is to raise awareness about civics education in Oregon. And you'll note that this bill was drafted at the request of the Classroom Law Project. And I know Barbara Rost is here today. And I can't say enough good things about the work of the Classroom Law Project in exposing students and their families across Oregon to civics. They run a remarkable number of programs for a small nonprofit organization, from the mock trial competition to We the People, Law Day, the Court Tour Program, and the list goes on and on. And it's been the mission of the Classroom Law Project, and I'm sure Barbara will explain it, but to increase the awareness and understanding about civics in Oregon. And I know they did a study a couple of years ago that tested the knowledge of Oregon students about civics. And I think the results were pretty dismal. I think most of the students scored about a D in their if they were graded on their knowledge of civics. And so what this bill does is that it declares that the first Friday in December is Oregon Civics Day, and it's to give the teachers an opportunity to learn about civics. And we're focusing on staff development in this particular bill so that teachers can incorporate more civics into their existing curriculum. And Classroom Law Project has done a Civics Day for teachers here at the Capitol for a couple of years in a row, and it's been a very successful event, and I wanted to have this bill drafted and passed to increase awareness about that and to really encourage teachers to participate in that professional development. And I know Barbara was on the task force that dealt with both civics education and personal finance education, which is coming up in our later bill, and perhaps she'll discuss that task force as well. So thank you for the opportunity for this bill to be heard today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to call up Barbara Ross, Andy Miller, and Bob Wilner all at once. We can talk about why our kids can't name their congressmen, but they can name the names of the Jonas Brothers.
Don't test me on that one, though.
She was in.
Andy's here.
She's okay.
She's.
Oh, seriously.
She came up to oppose this. Welcome.
Thank you. Nodded at me, so I think I'll go right ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for listening to information about Senate Bill 374 today. I greatly appreciate that. Again, my name is Barbara Rost, and I'm the Program Director at Classroom Law Project. And as Senator Bonamici mentioned, Classroom Law Project is a small Oregon nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to civic education at the K-12 level throughout the state and beyond, actually. With respect to Senate Bill 374, we certainly urge a yes vote, and I hope that's an easy vote for you because this bill is blessedly short, it is simple, and perhaps best of all, it doesn't cost a thing. With that, Senate Bill 374 recognizes the value of professional development for teachers. It asks school districts to urge teachers to participate in civics-related professional development, and it names the first Friday in December as a good day for doing so. And that's about the long and short of it. This bill, however, does have some whereases, and I don't know about you, but I personally find whereases somewhat annoying from time to time. But in this bill, I do think they are instructive. In this bill, they tell us that Oregon students need to know more about Oregon government. They tell us that when teachers learn more about government, then their students do too. The first whereas draws attention to the need for more and better civic education, and I think Senator Bonamici drew attention to the survey instrument that Classroom Law Project created in 2006. You have a copy of that in your material should you wish to look at that further, and it does indeed confirm what Senator Bonamici identified, and that's basically that graduating students in the state of Oregon on average would score a D. And that's also reflected in the NAEP assessments, the national civics test that's given at that national level. So Oregon is right in line with everyone else. Not happy to say, but at least is confirmed at that level. The second whereas in this bill connects teacher content knowledge with high-quality professional development instruction. And a great deal has been written about that. I've referenced one in my written comments, but suffice it to say that when teachers know more, so do their students. As a provider of professional development for teachers, Classroom Law Project has learned that a weak point, perhaps an Achilles heel, in many teachers' vast knowledge of social studies is their understanding of Oregon government. And that should come as no surprise because, after all, there's no text. There's no specific place to go to get that information. So professional development is a perfectly situated situation in order to provide information to teachers. When we provide direction in that area, we hear a lot of, oh, I didn't know that, from teachers when we provide Oregon-specific content. For example, at the conference that Senator Bonamici was referring to this last December, when we asked for a show of hands of the number, and these are social studies teachers, when we asked for a show of hands of how many for whom this was their first visit to the Capitol, the state Capitol building, a majority raised their hands. We had this, for many of them, they had never had direct contact with elected officials, and Senator Cruz isn't here right now, but he was one of the ones that participated in our workshop, as was Senator Bonamici, and it was a unique and wonderful time for that connection to occur. Teachers appreciate this opportunity, they value it, and importantly, they pass it along to their students. Last December, Governor Kulongoski proclaimed Friday, December 5th, 2008, as Civic Education Day, and you have that proclamation, a copy of that in your materials there as well. So the conference was held here at the Capitol, and teachers heard from the folks that I mentioned, in addition to justices from the Supreme Court and other constitutional scholars. And they left saying things like, I read their evaluations right before I came, and I heard things like, I want more workshops and more possibilities, and all teachers should attend. Well, we certainly agree, and passing Senate Bill 374 would help launch that effort. So I offered the December conference as a kind of professional development activity that could be going on statewide. There could be small in-house workshops in individual schools. That would be fine. We're not saying that every teacher has to come to a conference here at the Capitol, but I would hope they would at some point in their careers. But it's a nice way to get content-specific information to students. And I want to note that Senate Bill 374 merely asks school districts to encourage teachers to participate. We understand the tough economic times we're in. We are not about requiring, forcing, or mandating, but we hope that with the gentle urging asked in this bill, that we would, instead of, there's a quote from a teacher that just attended one of our workshops, and she said, and I will quote here, she said, "Now I'll teach civics instead of avoiding it like the plague." So instead of avoiding it like the plague, they would offer teaching civics as a welcome, fun, and academically rich endeavor. Good. And with that, I'll leave you with two quotes that came to my mind, both from justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. One is from Justice Brandeis, where he said, "The most important political office is that of private citizen." And Justice Learned Hand said, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women." I would say that taken together, those two quotes tell us that citizens must own it. They must own understanding of how important a thriving democracy is. And Senate Bill 374 takes a small step in helping teachers pass that knowledge on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Ms. Miller, did you have a statement here?
Chair House, members of the committee, thank you for the surprising opportunity to testify today.
On the list.
Was I on the list? My name is Andy Miller, and I come here today as a board member from the Carol and Velma Sailing Foundation. In the past 2 years, the Sailing Foundation has funded the Classroom Law Project, and this particular piece of it was what we funded last year, the training of the teachers. And I think the money is used to pay for the substitutes so the teachers can come here and other costs. I don't even know if Barbara knows, but they were awarded the grant this year for this project, too. So there is no fiscal on this bill, and that is, I think, in large part thanks to the Sailing Foundation. I am obviously very interested in seeing this piece. In my prior professional life, I wanted to do this, and I could never get the funding together. So this is a fabulous, fabulous project. And if you get a chance to participate, you will learn more from the kids than you will teach them. And thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Wilner, we have your written testimony here if you want to summarize it.
All right, if I may.
Sure.
I'm afraid I'm here to make some trouble. My name is Robert Wilner. I'm executive director of the Oregon International Council, a nonprofit organization established in 1983 to try to carry out the recommendations of the then Oregon Governor's Commission on Foreign Language and International Studies to broaden the horizons of Oregon students, graduates, citizens. And let me say, I'm speaking on my own behalf, however, not for the other organizations I may mention. But I will say that before I came to Oregon, I was in the Foreign Service for 23 years, which I believe made me a practitioner of the social studies. And I came away even more convinced than I had been of the importance of social studies for every citizen, for our country, and for our state. Preparing citizens to run a democracy is, I think, really what public education is all about. And in that sense, I would certainly support this emphasis on civics education that's been discussed. But I would argue that civics education in a vacuum is not going to be effective, that I think our students need not only a knowledge of how the government operates, but of the context in which it operates, economic, to begin with. They have to know how the economy works, or as in recent case, how it doesn't work. They have to know something about the whole political framework in which it operates, about the geography in which we operate. Increasingly, we're part of a world complex, and they have to know that. So, social studies were redefined some years ago in terms of history, geography, civics, and economics. And I think that is an essential context for our students to grow up in, to learn, to recognize. And I love the idea of the Civics Day, but there has to be economics and a geography and a history day as well, or they should be all put together, because without that framework, without that overall framework, I don't think our citizens can be effective. And that's my concern with this bill. I would like to see the context broadened so that we really do recognize that students have to know something about the state, something about the nation, something about the world, and how we fit together. And that's a crucial issue. And I realize this is not a good time to talk about expanding expenses on education, but I think if we're going to invest money in social studies education, I think it has to be in this broader context.
Okay.
And I thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Wilner. And just as a way of explanation, the way I read the bill, the Oregon is where the education is taking place. It is not limited to civics about Oregon. And we specifically didn't define civics in here, and it says, whereas studies show that most students lack a proficient understanding of civics, including government, history, law, and democracy. So it is intended to be broad, and it says to learn about civics in Oregon, and it's not limited to specifically Oregon civics. That's my understanding, and I hope Barbara will agree with me. But thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
You all. I have a question. Sorry, Senator Metzger.
Well, maybe a comment, maybe you might react to it, just because I'm also a co-sponsor of this bill, and I like it, and I appreciate you know, bringing it forward. But just would want to be clear, if we move forward on this, and I think it's a good thing to do that, while we're encouraging school districts to have teachers participate on the first Friday, I really want to make it clear that this doesn't somehow become interpreted by school districts for another non-contact day with teachers, with students. I mean, you know, we have districts between 7 and 9 days. We're already talking about worrying about having contact days with students. And I would hope that, because this is very important, to make it clear that districts, if all teachers be involved, that this would be considered valuable enough to be used as one of the existing non-contact days and not as another non-contact day of our very small school year. I just want to make sure that's clear, because I could see how someone down the road could interpret this saying, well, we need another day of non-contact with students so we can participate in civics, rather than saying this is important enough that this might encompass one of our existing non-contact days.
Good point.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on SB 364, and I'll open a work session on SB 374.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 374 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 374 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? See none. Any objections to adopting Senate Bill 374 with a due pass recommendation? See none. So ordered. Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry this?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 501. Ms. Richardson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 501 adds finances to the rigorous academic content standards that must be regularly reviewed by the State Board of Education. It requires school districts to provide curriculum and finances that would apply to the 2010-2011 school years and subsequent school years. You also have fiscal and revenue statements on this measure.
Senator Metzger, did you want to...
Yeah, I would, and I don't know if it adds to my credibility, so I'll just stay up here rather than go down, but... I do have a few comments and appreciate the discussion we'll have on Senate Bill 501, and this may get to some of the things Mr. Wilner was just talking about, but in a time when our state, our national and world economics are struggling, Senate Bill 501 I think could be a very important piece of legislation. It's critical that schools teach our children the basics in financial literacy. Oregon students should graduate with a comprehensive understanding of earning, spending, saving, investing money. Financial skills should be incorporated into current curriculum by using real-life examples, using credit card examples to learn about interest and principal payments, using a checkbook to illustrate basic arithmetic, learning about the difference a down payment makes on a payment of a car or a home, and the possibilities are endless. And I have faith in our teachers' creativity to successfully incorporate essential skills into standard curriculum. Now, these real-life examples complement current teachings, but will instill the basic financial tenets in our students that are so readily lacking across the country. Now, this committee has already made a very positive step in trying to increase financial literacy in our schools by supporting the effort to add our state treasurer to the Board of Education. SB 501 complements the work we've already done and will prove to be a benefit to our students. By making this an essential skill, I will point out, and you will hear probably in some of the testimony, that this was a recommendation of the Financial Literacy Task Force as the best way to move students into this direction. We have, as witnessed by the results of the task force, a wide variety of teaching that is going on in financial literacy, and a lot of it, the evidence shows, is pretty well tied to the individual instructor who decides to use these types of examples to maximize, for example, teaching in mathematics to meet state standards. But by making it an essential skill, we focus more on using those real-life examples to accomplish multiple tasks, which is not only, say, mathematics or English or the arts or civics, but also to use these essential skills as part of that teaching curriculum. And I think this will help us focus on that, so rather than being hit and miss, we'll have a more broad-based approach to financial literacy in our schools.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Wisnett, there he is.
He's on the next
Rec.
One.
From Bend. Where is Bend?
Over by Sun River.
Oh, that's right. It's a suburb of Sun River.
Mr. Chair, and honorable committee members, what a great committee here, including Senator Cruz. I'm not speaking about my Oregon song. For the record, Representative Gene Wisnett from District 53, Sun River, and... this is an interesting bill. I found out from LC that I dropped the same bill as Senator Metzger.
Great minds think alike, Mr. Chair.
And it's because I attended the workshop that he was chairing, and I do think this is an important issue. Senator Bonamici knows that the last two sessions I've introduced legislation to add one-half credit of civics education and financial management back to the graduation requirements, and we didn't get very far with those bills. So after attending the Financial Literacy Institute or seminar that we had that back in January, I drafted a bill which was the same as this bill, and Senator Metzger has nicely agreed to let me co-sponsor it as it comes over to the House. I think the senator also has demonstrated why we need this bill. Again, instead of drafting the bills like I'd done in the past, knowing that we weren't going to be able to take so long to add requirements to the graduation requirements, I think this is a good way to help our students learn financial literacy and not have to go through, you know, the long process it takes to add another course to the graduation requirements. Last time our bill was Senator Bonamici, House Bill 2584 did create the task force, and that's what led to the institution. And I think we all know that we don't have to look very far to see why we need financial literacy with all the financial problems our country and the nation are facing, and the world. Financial literacy is very important in our society. and the education system needs to find some way to provide that to our youth. And I think that what Senator Metzger and I have come up with will achieve that. I talked to the school board and passed a letter off to them to ask them to provide this training in the essential skills levels. And they think that they can do that, especially within the new math requirements that we've added. This morning in Ways and Means Education, the school board was, there's a Department of Education was testifying that about the dangerous school designation that your school committee administrator members we talked about in education during the interim. And we were able to solve that by rules, changing the rules and the definition without a new bill. But this one I felt needed a bill. Senator Metzger obviously did too, that we want to be sure that the Board of Education does add this specific training in the essential skills level. So that's why I dropped the bill and Senator Metzger did, and I would appreciate the committee's support in voting this bill forward.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We do have some people signed up. I know the credit unions are here in full force. Pam Levitt is here, signed up. I have Carolyn Roy signed up. Others from credit unions who... Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be before this committee. I've had the pleasure of being in Senate business and Senate consumer protection, but not this committee, so happy to be here this afternoon. On behalf of the 83 state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon, we're here today to support Senate Bill 501, a bill to add finances to essential learning skills and require school districts to provide...
Excuse me, Pam, if you want to start off with your name and
I'm sorry.
ID number.
For the record, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. In the bill, Senate Bill 501, finances is defined as curriculum designed to achieve financial literacy and to give students personal financial management skills by teaching the basic principles involved with earning, spending, saving, and investing money. I'd like to thank Senator Metzger and Representative Wisnett for all their work on this issue. A 2007 article in the Oregonian said that students listed personal finance as one of the top skills they still needed in high school but were not getting. Credit unions have recognized that this is an important issue over the many years, and we've been working hard in our schools and in our credit unions and in our communities to teach financial literacy. Financial illiteracy results in poor spending, saving, and investment decisions that can lead consumers using excessive credit just to make ends meet. And we all see that this during this economic time that's happening. Millions of Americans are headed for rocky waters as credit debt hits record highs at the very same time that personal savings rates are hitting record lows. This is not only a recipe for financial disaster on a very personal level, but also one with serious national consequences. Clearly, economic and financial illiteracy has become a front-page issue. There is a national and indeed worldwide climate of concern and a sense of crisis. Financial education in schools has never been more needed than it is right now. Financial literacy is crucial to building a future as a knowledgeable consumer. Without it, a consumer can't make decisions about buying a car, shopping for a good rate on a mortgage, saving for retirement, buying cost-effective insurance, or creating a family budget. I won't read my entire testimony, but I did want to give you a little bit of background. The Financial Education and Civics Task Force report is included in your packet. We were very much involved in helping to create that task force, and it did include a credit union representative. And after several months of the study, the task force reported back to the committees with their recommendation, and we support that recommendation, which is to demonstrate financial literacy as an essential skill for the Oregon diploma and to recognize that financial education is a basic component of K through 12 education. That is on page 23 of your report that I provided. personal finance is now included, in at least to some extent, in educational standards in 40 states. That's up from 34 states in 2004 and 21 states in 1998. 28 states now require these standards to be implemented. We obviously think that we need to take the next step. I know that our members, credit unions around the state and other lenders and other entities are teaching financial education, teaching personal finance, but it's not being done statewide. And that's why we, over the course of several legislative sessions, have had legislation dealing with this issue. We convened, as you heard, Representative Wisnett State, a financial education summit meeting. The participant list is in your packet. I thought that was interesting for you to review because it was really a cross-section of a variety of entities who came together. We pulled this together in 3 months, and I think we had over 70 participants who stepped up, and Senator Cruz was there. Thank you. Senator Metzger attended, and really you could feel the need in the room that people felt this is an important issue. I also included an example of an educational program that we use, the National Endowment for Financial Education. There's a brochure in there that shows some of the curriculum that we already use. I want to thank you. We recognize that teaching financial literacy is a challenge for teachers as their responsibilities in schools increase. We certainly empathize with all of the overwhelming issues that they have to struggle with day to day, but we strongly believe that financial education must become a priority for parents, teachers, and policymakers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carlin Roy. I'm with OSU Federal, a community credit union in Corvallis, Oregon, serving 5 counties in the state of Oregon. We're here today to impress upon you the importance of financial education. Whether it's because of budget cutbacks or lack of priority, financial education is missing from within our schools. It's a piece that contributes to wise spending, not only wise management of debt, but also savings, in order to be able to deal with even the smallest financial crisis that might come along in the everyday consumers' lives. Money habits start early. In fact, we've been teaching now in the schools and have gone K through 12. If you don't have an example of financial education that reaches you through our educational system, you're only experiences with your role models. And if you have a financially illiterate parent, we will be raising financially illiterate children as well. In fact, we get many letters from students that our Director of Community Education reaches thanking us for delivering the education to them. In fact, one of them that I'll cite was from a young gentleman in high school who had never learned to balance a checkbook because he said his mother didn't have time. And his thank you was to us for taking the time to come into his classroom and teach him how to do it. That's an essential life skill. It should also be noted that 51% of college students today have over $3,000 in credit card debt. That's based on a study by the Jumpstart Coalition. Individuals need to understand the basics of budgeting, understand being able to make the choice between a need and a want. That's one of the key decisions in helping our consumers be able to have a strong financial position in their lives. It's fundamentals, from counting money to being able to understanding the choice between using a credit card for a purchase or a debit card for a purchase. What you need to know when you buy your first car. What does a credit report mean to you? When you handle your credit, how does that impact all the choices you make in your life? Whether you learn to read using phonetics or whether it was the memorization rote method, when we all started school, there was some basic components of literacy that started when we entered the school year and the school curriculums. Everything we did was age appropriate and built on the skills we'd already learned. It's imperative that financial literacy start at a young age. We have a full-time employee dedicated to delivering financial education within the 5 counties that we serve. In 2008, she was able to reach more than 4,800 people. Now, that is adults and children. About 2,500 of them were students within the K-12 system. We have 279 schools within our five counties, and she was only able to reach classrooms within 30. In order to reach more, we've actually partnered with community organizations and with Oregon State University, their SIFE program, Students in Free Enterprise. Just last month, in conjunction with the SIFE program, we were able to conduct a half day of educational financial literacy training, age-appropriate, K through 8, to all 320 students at Franklin School in Corvallis, Oregon. It was an exciting day, it was interactive, and again, it was age-appropriate, building on what students would know if they go through the program 1 year after another after another. A half day. We've also partnered with other organizations, community colleges, drug courts, private entities, as well as numerous schools to deliver financial education. We can't handle it all. Even our credit union partners, we couldn't reach every school in the state of Oregon proactively with volunteer staff. It's important that the state support these efforts. Therefore, we endorse this bill's efforts to bring financial education back into our schools. Many states, as Pam referenced, have it as mandatory in their curriculum. This would be the first step in bringing us in line with the other 40 states. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Morse?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Carlin, thank you very much for coming in. And on behalf of the committee, I'd like to formally acknowledge the role of the credit unions in stepping up and being a part of the solution and addressing this need. And thank you for the other constituents mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in my district that have come today to support this. And, you know, there's more that the rest of the financial institutions can be doing as well to help. Mm-hmm. But you have taken the lead, and we are very, very appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, thank you, Blair.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, going down the list here, I have Steve Marlowe. Did you want to weigh in on this? I think you might have signed up for the both bills. Barbara Ross, did you want to weigh in on this?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm Barbara Rost from Classroom Law Project. I'm not here in my capacity as Program Director at Classroom Law Project, but rather reflecting on my work on the legislatively created task force on civic and financial education. And I'm taking a neutral stand on this proposed bill. I don't know whether it's a good bill or a bad bill because I just heard about it when I walked in the door today. That's of concern to me that somehow I didn't know about it, but that's my fault. But in any case, what I would urge the committee think about is that at the direction of the legislatively created task force, we looked at this, and I agree with all of the information that's been presented. You know, the need for this knowledge is great and could not be greater in our economic times. And we reported back to this committee in October with our findings, and the committee urged us to be in touch with the State Board of Education, which we did. And we've been working with the State Board of Education, and they are considering these matters now. And I would just urge that with whatever direction you choose to go with this, that some connections and coordination is made with the State Board of Education, because they're working on this matter.
I appreciate that. And colleagues, you might note, we do have written testimony from Bob Reeves, who's working with the superintendent on this, and he goes into some detail about integrating what the department is doing along these lines. But he also says he supports this legislation. So.
Okay.
Thank you. Chuck Bennett, COSA. And David Williams
is where the cold water starts.
OSBA.
Well, sure, they come on the easy ones.
This, Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, this really isn't an easy one, and part of the problem with it, I'm not sure this bill does what I heard all the testimony around it thinking it does do. This and it's a kind of a concern. We're not real excited about having a lot of curriculum and a lot of work added to our portfolio in the troubled economic times we have, but I'm just concerned that we would be back here and there would be a question of, you know, you fellas stood in the back of the room, watched this happen, and it didn't do what we thought it did. And I'm kind of, I don't think this does what the task force intended it to do. We already have standards for personal finance under the economics section of essential skills, and that won't change. It just pulls it out and sets it, you know, highlights it, but it doesn't change it. And I think it doesn't set up, as I read the bill and talked with Department of Ed folks, it doesn't set up a graduation requirement in personal finances. And so I'm wondering if that's what you want. We're fine with the bill. I don't think it will change much about what we're doing, though, right now. And if the intention was to take, you know, to somehow change what schools are doing, I just worry that you would come back in 2 years and say, how'd that go? What'd you do differently? And you would find out we did nothing differently, because that's what this bill appears to us to say. No change. It just moves a few words around a little bit, but it doesn't change anything particularly. So I hope you'll take another look at the bill, and we'd be glad to work with you on it, so you can get a bill together we could, you know, really aggressively oppose, but that isn't where we are. But I would really feel derelict if I didn't alert you to this problem, so thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Very interesting testimony from my colleague, Mr. Bennett. I just want to add, if the under an assumption of crafting the bill such that it is adding a curricular requirement for school districts, just as a reality check, I do want to remind us all about the climate we're in. I was sitting down in Ways and Means this morning as the Department of Ed was finishing up the budget presentation on its operations and moves into the state school fund presentation, where they've been asked to present 20% reductions at 5% increments. That's on the order of a magnitude of 60 days lost out of schools, 30 days a year over the next 2 years. And then at the same time, you know, we have to look to add financial education or other all well-meaning issues into the curriculum when we're hemorrhaging here. We're not just leaking at the seams, and you know, I think we all need to kind of include that in our calculus as we review these types of proposals.
Appreciate that, Senator. Hold on. Any questions?
I have a question.
This is Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. I guess this question is for Chuck. Do you know if the you said personal finance is already included under economics? Do you know if it aligns with the definition of finances that are in this bill on page 1, lines 19 through 21?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonamici, I believe it does. Now, whether it is precise to this, but it does cover each of these various aspects of personal finance in terms of savings and spending and all the rest of it, is my understanding. You know, it'd be worth it to take a look if it does. It may well be not. It may well not be as inclusive as the current description, but I think that's something you all may want to take a look at. Make sure you're getting. Just I know from my own experience as a member, it's always better to pass a bill that does something than one that and does something better. So you might want to take a look at that.
Thank you.
Mr. Morris?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I guess I'd pose this by way of a question. Are there opportunities to integrate finances as it's defined and proposed in the bill in the curriculum of other subjects so that it is learned in an applied way, different than maybe what presently is being done?
I'm not sure, Senator. I understand.
Mr. Chair, as Senator Metzger and I were visiting before the hearing opened today, in the instance of math,
yeah,
teaching math, what a wonderful way to teach personal finance. Is that happening today?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, I believe it is happening. I think the way it's happening, if I understand it correctly, I haven't been in the high schools to see how it's being done, or middle schools, however it is taught. It is coming under the economics portion. And I assume that you're probably getting it in mathematics in some way, at least the skill. You'd have to be gaining the skills in order to accomplish the kind of goals that would be outlined in personal finance. Again, though, my understanding is it comes under the economics. Folks at Department of Ed, though, would be really expert in that. I'm just basing it on kind of a quick understanding and talking with them in how it fits into the curriculum precisely.
And on that note, I was wondering where personal finance is taught. If there's is it in the high school spectrum? Is it course?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chairman. Again, I think the Department of Ed is the expert on is it a section? Is it you take economics and inside economics is a section on personal finance and how your personal finance fits into the broader field? I assume that's how it's done. I think it's really their call on how that's done. I'm just concerned that after listening to the testimony and listening to the questions and comments, that this bill is not accomplishing what folks think it's accomplishing.
Okay.
Okay.
I know we have the Department of Education here. I'm not sure they're prepared to get into that level of detail.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and joining me is Andy Morgan, who's our expert on this topic. But I'll make a few general comments about the bill. Our friends from COSA and OSBA were asking us some questions, and I think part of the confusion stems from, if I remember, the recommendations of the Civics and Financial Education Task Force were essentially that students would need to demonstrate knowledge of personal finance before they could graduate. And in 1997, I believe it was, the legislature removed a half-credit requirement, which is what Representative Wisnett was talking about earlier today. And since then, I think the general consensus amongst a lot of the folks here today is that students are not learning personal finance to the extent that they need to be before they graduate. Part of the confusion today, I think, stems from that we keep hearing the term essential skills thrown out. And if you look at the bill, on page 2, line 44, it talks about essential learning skills. And what essential learning skills essentially are the subjects that schools are required to teach. It's your basic math, science, reading, PE, civics, financial stuff. So those are essential learning skills. In the administrative rules that the State Board of Education has adopted for the Oregon High School Diploma, they have something called essential skills, which are, I believe there's 9 of them that students need to demonstrate. For the first time with the new Oregon Diploma, students are going to demonstrate that they can write and read and do math and speak publicly and several other things before they can get their diploma. And that can be done through getting credits through classes. That can be done through credit for proficiency, like doing a voc tech program or other things like that, where you're demonstrating that you have the math skills. So if the intention of this bill is to make sure that students graduate from high school with a certain level of personal finance knowledge, this bill does not do that. What this bill says is that there is a sort of a new type of curriculum. Finances is what it's called in the bill. But essentially, and I'll let Andy talk a little more about this, but under the economics header right now in the standards, students are required to learn personal finance. And in the administrative rules that the State Board of Education has adopted for the new high school diploma, there's a 3-credit unit that includes geography, economics, social studies, and it specifically calls out personal finance. it doesn't attribute that you have to take a half credit of personal finance or a full credit of personal finance. So it needs to be mixed into what we're doing. So that hopefully sort of provides a backdrop. I think maybe there's just a little bit of confusion of terms with these essential learning skills and essential skills related to the Oregon diploma. So with that, I know Andy has some answers to your questions that
Thank
I think
you,
we can help with.
Ms. Morgan?
Yes. For the record, I'm Andrea Morgan. I'm the Social Sciences Curriculum Specialist for Oregon Department of Education. Mr. Chair and Committee, personal finance is one of those areas that is already required in the Oregon standards, which means that schools are required to provide instruction to all of the standards. So there's a section of economics that address the very areas that you've listed as finances in this. It appears in some ways like this would just lift those standards out, move them over, and give them their own title. And currently we're in the review and revision process for the social sciences standards. We know that there needs to be some, I'm going to call it augmentation to the personal finance standards, simply because things have changed since 1999 when those standards were written originally. And so we're going to be adding some topics to them, most likely, to make them more current. But the standards exist. There is still instruction required to them. Some districts still provide a half unit of personal finance. Others have begun to include that in their economics curriculum and in economics courses. And still others are putting it in. I've heard of one district, for instance, that puts it in a senior seminar class. And so not only are they writing resumes and doing some other things, they're also doing the personal finance curriculum at the same time. So they're studying credit, making sure that these kids are ready to be launched out into the world once they leave high school with some kind of knowledge about finance. So there's a variety of ways that this is done. We also see it supported in the mathematics curriculum. So as students are learning about percentages and other things, they're also learning some of the concepts of personal finance, and it's already integrated. As we heard about the states that have standards and have requirements, Oregon stands among those because we have standards and the districts are required to provide instruction. Now, when the task force, and I staffed the task force, did their investigation, what we found is that it's one of those areas that it's difficult, and there's some other reasons why we're seeing maybe not the kind of instruction that we would all hope and dream for our schools. But it isn't simply because we don't have standards. It's because of some other reasons of the changes that happened in the curriculum requirements. So at this point, we have standards. We know that they need some improvement, and we fully intend to do that. And we know that districts are providing some of that instruction, but maybe not highlighting it in the way that this bill might do by moving the standards.
You were on the we're talking about two different task forces.
I staff, Mr. Chair, I staff the Civics and Financial Education Task Force.
Did you ever bring that up when these summaries and recommendations are coming through?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We talked about the standards, and I think if you read the recommendations of the task force, they were asking that it be named a 10th essential skill for the diploma, not that it simply have the standards moved into a new section. And so I think the recommendations of the task force are a little bit different than what this bill would actually do.
Okay. Other questions, Senator Metzger?
Yeah. And you may be correct in the way it's drafted, because in Section 3, it's ORS 329.025, and what you're saying is the essential learning skills aren't identically aligned with the state board essential skills. So what we would need to do in amending this, because as you know, when you get first drafts, they don't always come out exactly what you want, is to make it clear that it's the state board of education essential skills which would then show proficiency, which would lead in curriculum development for proficiency for an Oregon diploma, is how that would need to be worded. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I think I think the general idea is correct. We need to talk to Cindy Hunt and Legislative Council and see if that is possible to put in statute, because the nine essential skills that exist right now for the Oregon diploma are all in administrative rule created by the State Board of Education. The legislature has put the 24 credits into statute, and then the board filled that in with sort of what the content of those 24 credits would have to be. So I guess the one thing I would say, I think that may be possible, but then that would be the only essential skill in statute. The other ones would all be an administrative rule created by the board.
Right, but the administrative rules always follow statute. So if we wanted the board to produce that as an essential skill, we could do that through legislation to ensure that happened. And by the way, I think Cindy Hunt is now with you.
Right.
Yeah, not with Legislative Council anymore, yeah.
Right.
But
I meant and Legislative Council.
Okay.
Together, working together.
But, Mr. Chairman, that is the purpose of it. And I think that's a good point out, so that, you know, Mr. Bennett can come and, you know, be more aggressive against him when we make it very clear that it is to be an essential skill, which would lead to, the task force report noted, I think it's on page 18, as the teachers that were involved in this, that were brought into this, is, you know, what is tested is taught. And so to make it an essential skill, it's going to have to be tested, and therefore we will teach it. So I think, Mr. Chair, that we need probably some nuancing in the language of the bill as helped with our
essential
folks.
Skill as opposed to essential learning skills.
Yes.
And, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to have Andy and myself and Cindy Hunt involved in any of that process. I think the one thing that we did hear loud and clear on the task force is that there is some dissatisfaction in the way this is being taught in our schools. And while there are great examples and our private sector partners have stepped up and helped a lot, there could be some improvement.
You're getting some head nods.
So.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Ms. Morgan and Mr. Morgan. And I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 501. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 64.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 64 clarifies the distribution and expenditure of certain amounts of local revenues received by component school districts of education service districts, declares an emergency, and would take effect July 1st, 2009. We have a -1 amendment before us as well that would essentially extend the bill through the 08-09 school year distribution. You have fiscal and revenue statements on both the bill and the -1 amendment.
Okay. I'm sorry. We're still in public hearing, and we have Mr. Morgan back at us here.
And Brian Reeder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, continuing my tradition of clearing your room with another exciting Department of Education bill this session. So, Senate Bill 64... actually resolves a statutory conflict, and we need to provide some clear direction to our education service districts that actually have excess local revenue. There are two statutes, ORS 327019 and ORS 334177, that give conflicting direction to education service districts with respect to local revenue. In the testimony coming out, ORS 327019 basically says that local school districts who have revenue that exceeds their general service grant from the state school fund, they need to distribute that excess local revenue to their component school districts. So just to kind of relate it to school districts, as you guys know, there's a few school districts like Jewell and Seaside on the coast that actually have more money coming in from their local tax revenues and actually don't get any money from the state as part of their state school fund grant. Well, there are actually three ESDs in Eastern Oregon that get more local revenue and then they don't get any money from the state school fund. And this statute says that anytime that happens for an ESD, that extra money goes out to their component school district. So, for example, if their state school fund grant mixed with their local or not mixed with their local revenues, but is $1 million and they get $1.3 million, then that $300,000, they need to kick that out to their component school districts, unlike the school districts need to. In ORS 334, it basically says that an education service district board shall spend at least 90% of all amounts received from the state school fund and at least 90% of all amounts of their local revenues on programs or services that are approved by the component school district. So like this statute basically says that 90% of the money that an ESD gets needs to be spent on services and programs approved by their local school district. So as you can see, there's conflicting direction to our ESDs. For example, and if an ESD distributes its excess revenue to its component school districts as required by ORS 327019, it might not have enough money to meet the 90% requirement of ORS 334177. So what we propose to do with Senate Bill 64 is to actually do two things. The first thing we need to do is clean this statute up. This conflict can't go on. And the second thing we need to do is hold the component school districts of ESDs that may have been impacted and the ESDs that have experienced excess local revenue harmless. So essentially the bill only affects ESDs and component school districts if they have local revenue in excess of their general purpose grant. And we know of three ESDs that are affected, all east of the mountains in Region 18 ESD, the Grant ESD, and the North Central ESD. Because we're aware of the statute, we have not been counting the money that goes to the component school districts as local revenue. Technically, that should, when the ESD has local revenues that exceed their general purpose grant, and then they kick it out to their component districts, the component districts should be counting that as local revenue, and they have not been doing that. So essentially what we're doing with this bill is it says anything that's happened dating back to, I believe in the bill, it's the 2003-2004 school year, any decisions you made based on either one of these statutes are okay. We're just going to say whatever has happened has happened. There was unclear statutory direction. So, and then what we want to do with ESDs is give clear direction with Senate Bill 64. So first the bill would require that they distribute their excess revenues to their component school districts, and then whatever they have left, they have to spend at least 90% of that on programs approved by the school district. So now that I've thoroughly confused myself and probably all of you, I brought Brian Reeder with me to dig me out of whatever hole I've dug with the committee, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Maybe just to give a hypothetical example of the problem that the conflict creates.
Could you start off with your name?
I'm sorry, Brian Reeder, Department of Education. Morgan's example, district is guaranteed $1 million through the formula, but they collect $1.3 million of their own local revenue. So they are required under 327019 to give that excess $300,000 out to their component school district. So they just have $1 million left after they've distributed that money. Well, 334 says you have to spend 90% of that $1.3 million on resolution services for your districts. Well, they don't have 90% of $1.3 million anymore because they gave away $300,000. They've only got 90% of $1.3 million is about, something a little less than $1.2 million, but they've only got $1 million left. So they can't spend 90% of $1.3 million. So what this statute simply does is say that 90% requirement is applied to what you have left after you've made the distribution of your excess revenue.
Is there a policy decision in not counting that as formula?
Chair Haas, I guess I don't quite know what you mean by a policy decision. The problem we've encountered is that districts, because of the conflict in these two laws, a third statute, the statute that requires the districts to count when these are school districts now who are getting money from the ESD, that revenue they're supposed to count as their own local revenue. Because of the conflict in these other two statutes, that statute really, it's hard to know how to apply that. If 327019 is not valid, then 327013 really can't be applied in any consistent way. So our decision is, no matter how they did it, we'll simply allow that to stand, and we'll clean this up and move forward from this point. The problem the districts are facing is they've spent that money and not in a position to give it back to the state school fund, essentially because they didn't count it as local revenue. The state school fund paid them too much, but they're not in a position to pay that back currently.
This may be a dumb question, but for those school districts, the component school districts that get this money, won't that be in excess of what they were expecting? I mean, isn't this like a surprise windfall, realizing that it's not a lot, but still?
Chair Haas, in some sense, yes. This is revenue on top of their own local property taxes, on top of their state school fund distribution. I don't know that they weren't expecting it. What they weren't expecting is to have to count it in their local revenue, or what wasn't clear to them because of the conflict in the law is that they were supposed to count that as local revenue. So they tended to budget for it and to spend it.
Well, how would they know then? How would they know this is happening unless they're in contact with the ESDs who say, hey, guess what? You may be in line for this excess because we have to give back to the component school districts.
Chair Haas, they knew they were going to get the money. What they didn't know was that it would, that they were required to include it in their local revenue, and that act, by including it in their local revenue calculation, would reduce their state school fund. So they knew where they were getting the money. What they didn't know is that it was more than they were entitled to.
No, I'm talking about the school districts.
And so am I.
I'll see.
But the way our formula works is that for every dollar that they got from their ESD of this excess revenue, their state school fund distribution should have been reduced by a dollar.
I understand that, but would they know that beforehand? Would they know that in one of these years, in the out years, say, in those examples that you just gave?
They don't know the tax base.
I'm sorry?
I said they don't know what the tax base is.
Right, and I think we, based on conversations with the ESDs, most if not all of their component school districts didn't understand that this was an offset to their state school fund. So they knew it was coming. What they didn't appear to know was that it was supposed to be, that it was supposed to reduce their state school fund distribution.
It was already built in. I guess that was my
correct
assumption. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as the global impact on the state school fund, it's not much. I guess my question is, because when the money still stays in the system and they're still buying services, my question is, what if the solution, because we got conflicting statutes here clearly, and an ESD that was supposed to get $1 million gets $1.3 million. So that money goes back in, but what if we just had the requirement that they still have to contract for 90% of the dollars, and nothing goes back to the component school district, so they're held, I mean, the school district's going to be held harmless one way or the other. Either they get the money from the ESD or they get it out of the formula. So, but I'm just questioning if the need for services that an ESD could provide would warrant them contracting for those additional services. So ultimately, for these small rural Eastern Oregon school districts, there would be a net gain in the system. I mean, was that a consideration? Or
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, we didn't discuss that as an option. Clearly, that would redistribute more of the big pot of state school fund money to those districts. So that would be a policy decision.
Yeah.
Our interest here was to fix the statute in a way that was consistent with what we think was the intent, and that is if an ESD raises more money locally than the formula guarantees them that that excess goes to their district, and then the state school fund formula kicks in the standard way. In other words, not giving them, not distributing more money to those component districts simply because their ESD has high local revenue.
Ms. Chair, I understand that. I guess I was just kind of looking kind of outside that box at the fact that we're dealing to a large degree with some struggling districts here and their ability to deliver the special ed services and things like that, if there's a compelling reason to consider that.
Well, Senator Cruz, as Brian said, the fix in Senate Bill 64 is what we think is the statutory intent of this, right. But I imagine that some of the superintendents in some of those small school districts might prefer, you were talking about they might like the services. I would speculate that many of them might just like the cash in the next 2 years as well.
Well, I understand that. I wasn't trying to game the formula. I was trying to look at the service delivery. So.
Yeah. So the other thing, Mr. Chair, I should have mentioned is I spoke to Ozzie Rose, who's the lobbyist for the Oregon Association of ESDs, and they are supportive of the bill. So.
Mr. Chair, I'm not, you know, I understand the fix.
Right.
Okay, I guess I was just trying to look at, right. at other aspects of these eastern ESDs have tremendous distances and getting pathologists and folks like that out to cover all the need is a real struggle for them. But that's probably a discussion for another point in time.
And Senator Cruz, what we'd hope to do with this bill is to avoid any potential litigation that might come up, because there is unclear statute, and as Mr. Reeder said, it is unclear whether the rules and laws governing the state school fund and the collection of excess payments would be able to be applied to what happened in these ESDs over the last 5 or 6 years.
Okay. Kind of feels like a revenue committee bill. Any other questions?
Just Mr. Chair, briefly, do we have a dash one amendment?
Oh,
is
yes,
that
sir.
Something we should address?
Excuse me, Mr. Sorry. Chair, Senator Bonamici, very good point. The dash one amendment just adds the current school year. So it goes, the bill on page one, line 20, we've essentially grandfathered or made retroactive or okayed any actions that have occurred since the 2003-2004 school year. And the dash one amendment just brings it through the current school year. So whatever happens through this school year is okay. And then again, the fix is starting with the 09-10 school year, the extra revenue first gets kicked out to the component district, so then it matches their state school fund grant, and then they have to spend 90% of that on services and other things that the component school districts want, just to make that very clear.
Okay. Further questions?
I just got one other question. Well, actually, two, Mr. Chair. I don't want to confuse this one with this bill, so I'd like to ask Mr. Reeder a question after we've done whatever we have with this bill. It's related, but it's just for the audio recording. Don't want to make a difference. But I was wondering from Oregon there as if I noticed on the amendment that we are going to inert 0708. So if we inert, does that not exclude it from being put in? I mean, because it's inert, it doesn't apply. Is that right?
Defer to legislative counsel.
Senator Mesper will defer to our legislative counsel friends on that one.
Yeah, I think so.
But the intention is
to insert.
To insert, yes.
Okay. All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 64 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 64.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Morris.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 64.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 64. Discussion? Seeing none. If not, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 64 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 64 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, Senate Bill 64 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The carrier, Mr. Chair.
This feels like a revenue committee issue. It feels like a Senator Morse.
Okay. I'll just have Dana sit closely.
And I'll call Morgan.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question of Mr. Rieger?
Yes.
Mr. Rieger, this came up in this discussion here as you're talking about local dollars and then how it affects state distribution. Because this might become before a committee, I hope it doesn't have to, but I did receive a panic call from one of my superintendents, Pat Brady in Hood River, who has local option equalization, in which the state, if they raise money on a local option but are below the average weighted property taxes, they're to get money from the state. And there's a number of districts, but I don't know if it's any of your districts, but mine's one of them, and they haven't received the $2,008 dollars, and they're worried about the $2,009 and $2,010 dollars. Can you update on what's, where that money is and when they might be getting that, what the state needs to pay them for their local dollars that they've raised?
Chair Haas, Senator Metzger, yes, this is a program that the legislature put in place, I believe, in the 01 or 03 session. It's called the Local Option Equalization Grant Program for school districts that impose a local option property tax and whose assessed value per weighted student is below the 75th percentile. They will get a grant from the state to bring their local option revenue up to where it would have been had they been at the 75th percentile. So a little complicated there, but essentially for what it does is give a little extra money to low property value districts that impose local option property taxes for schools. Hood River, I believe, has had a local option and has received the grant in the past, and they renewed their grant in last November, I believe. Well, what the law also says is that if a district imposes one of these, I'm sorry, they renewed their local option tax. No, I said their grant, but they renewed their local option tax. What the law says is if a district passes a local option after the legislature has adjourned, then they need to wait an extra year to get their grant from the state because the legislature hasn't appropriated enough money to give them that grant. There's no money there because the legislature wasn't aware of the local option. So they're entitled to the grant, but the payment won't occur until the legislature has a chance to make an appropriation that's large enough to do that. So that's their 07-08 issue. Under the law, they're entitled to that grant, but we simply, the state doesn't have the money to pay them because it wasn't in the appropriation from the 07 legislature.
So does that mean those districts won't receive those dollars? Because I know they've all budgeted them.
Well,
thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair.
Chair Haas, Senator Metzger, that all depends on whether the legislature chooses to take back the money that was appropriated for those grants, or which was sitting in the e-board. The department has asked for those funds to make those grant payments. I'm not sure what the status of that is at the moment. But for the 09-11 biennium, districts who have those local option taxes and who were expecting those grants, that depends on whether the legislature appropriates the money to pay those grants.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I actually had an email exchange with the House co-chair on this topic last week. And as Mr. Rieger said, the department has some of the money for these local option equalization grants was held back by the e-board. And last fall, and then again just on February 24th, we had sent letters to the Ways and Means Committee asking for the release of those funds. I believe it's Fall City, Hood River, and one other district. I can't remember that. And there was about $275,000, I believe, owed to these districts. And I can actually send you a copy of the letter we sent on February 24th. And my understanding was that in the rebalancing budgets that passed out, that this money that had been set aside, you know, essentially the legislature zeroed out every pot of money. So I don't actually know if there's going to be money available to make those payments for the current school year. I talked to Sue McGlashan, our finance director, on that, and she thinks that the money just all reverted back and was spent by the legislature. So I can look into that further for you. But that's I had an initial email exchange with the House co-chair on that topic.
Well, thank you. That would be disappointing. Just members, just when we did that, that was to encourage local communities who didn't have a lot of money, but to max out, you know, what they could locally, to encourage them to help us, and then we would give them a little bit, you know, if their citizens would step up and pass local options. And it kind of takes some of the local option flavor away when you have low property assessed value districts, and they say, well, you know, even if we go X percent, it doesn't raise a lot of money, but it's a big burden on us. And so we did this as a way to help partner with local communities to step up and help us a little bit more. So it'd be disappointing if we reneged on that, because I know those districts, and I think one of them I thought might be in New Matilla or Pendleton, but I could be wrong about that. Is also part of that. I don't know if Mr. Nelson, Senator Nelson, knows that yet, but I would appreciate any more update on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me on that.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Stick around. Committee, you have been distributed to your offices the hard copy of the Multnomah ESD audit, and you have, as I mentioned earlier, the OHSU letter. So any further action? Seeing none, we are adjourned.